Accession number 31699, reel 5.
Oh yes, of course, while I was out there, yes, I mentioned this, while I was out in Algiers, or Mason Carey, I was still flight mechanic engines, officially, but working on transport. But the place was awash with flight mechanics, engines, and I think the other part of airframes. That's typical of forces. They didn't know what they were doing. Everybody was a flight mechanic. So it came out on DRO, daily routine orders. If people like to remuster to fit a mode of transport, would they contact so-and-so? And I looked at it and I thought, well, yes, perhaps. That's a good idea. And I
help yourself.
I saw the sergeant and I said, well, I'd like to remuster. But I said, before I do, I'd like to go around the workshops. Okay, he said, take your time. So I went around. I'd done a bit of engine rebuilding, but I hadn't done anything much on gearboxes and back axles and front axles. So I spent quite a long time in the workshops working out how axles, well, I knew how axles work, how you take them apart and the adjustments and all that sort of thing. And eventually I decided that the time was okay, so I thought, well, I'll take the test. So I told the flight sergeant, and he said, okay. He said, we'll do this tomorrow morning. And we were working at that particular time in Nissen Hut workshops. And he said, okay, that morning, he said, get a bench, we put it out the back. And he said, sit down. And we spent a lot of time, he spent a lot of time with me asking questions about this and that. How would you do this? How would you do that? And now if you had so-and-so, and he was marking it out all in the sand outside. And he said, if you did so-and-so, so-and-so, how would you get out of the problem? And I told him. And the whole test, well, that type of test, that part of the test, I suppose it took about a morning, complete morning. Then in the afternoon, I hadn't finished, in the afternoon, we went round the scrapyard, and there were dozens and dozens of vehicles, all left over from the war. Some have got French markings on, some have got German markings on, and some were Canadian, some were British, all manner of stuff. And he'd stop at one. How would you take the gearbox out of that? And I'd tell him. And move on. Stop by another Ford V8 engine in the was a war one, semi-derelict and complete. A lot of caramelization went on, as you can imagine. He said, how do you fit that engine into an English Ford? I said, you can't. I said, they don't fit. Right. And this went on all the afternoon, up and down the rows of vehicles, and just pick out one. Say, how would you do so and so? And there was a Bedford, I think. There was a Bedford there, he said. What would be the first thing you'd look at on the Bedford? I said, the transfer box, it comes loose. That was all right. And I suppose the whole thing lasted about a day. And I said, have I passed? He said, yes. So my pay went up considerably, and the stripes were on my arm. I was when I was in Aden, I ended up in charge of workshops. You know, the mechanical side of it. In overall, Charles was the warrant officer. He did all the paperwork. Oh, I was very pleased about that. So, as I say, I got. You mind if I pick the spoon? We've got to have a bit of sugar in these things. And that's how I think the course over here was about 6 months. I did the whole thing in a day with practical experience previous.
So, when was it then that you returned from North Africa?
I returned from North Africa in 1944, I think it was. Yes, it was. I spent two and a half years there, in all. And then I think we were about eight of us came back on the plane. On the last day, we left Mason Blanche at about 4 a.m. in the morning, you know, with all that kit. DC-3, Dakota, US Air Force. Clapped out plane that was, too. I looked at the propellers. The propellers gone silver with sand. Sand had been sandblasted. And they couldn't get one of the engines running either. Couldn't get it started. And I thought, oh my God, fathers. Eventually they did. And it was a. It must have been a plane used for parachutists, paratroops. And off we went. The navigator, I remember, he was sitting at his desk with his feet up on the desk, and he got a comic in his back pocket. And I went over to him, I said, "What are you putting down in France?" "Oh," he said, "we're not going to put down in France. We've probably got enough fuel to get you home." He said, "If we run out of fuel," he said, "we'll put down somewhere." Oh, I thought, my godfathers. He did it from Mason Blanche, North Africa, to Lynham. Just in one tank of fuel. So what he had left in that plane, I hate the thing.
How long did it take then?
I don't know, really. I don't know. Can't tell you. But I know we flew right across France to get back. It was quite it was uncomfortable.
This was after D-Day then, Bridget, was it?
Oh, yes. 1940. Yes, there's another thing I remember about Mason Blanche, going back again. Is that all right? We used to sleep in big Romney huts. They were the quarters. And these Romney huts contained two-tier bunks. There were dozens of them. And if you can imagine, all those men, I think we had three of them. Two or three of these big Romney huts. And if you can imagine what the smell was like in the morning when you got up. Oh, very powerful, I can tell you. And we all complained about it. So, what did they do? Took some of the sheathing off the front of the Romney hut, didn't they? Lovely. Where was I billeted? Where was my bunk? Right underneath the front. You think, oh, that's lovely, fresh air and all the rest of it. Not so good when it rained. Every night you went to bed. Of course, I was on top, all underneath. Muggins was on top. So every time you went to bed, you put your ground sheet over. Keep off the rain. And I can still remember one morning waking up and tipping the water off my bed. And it was coming back to the Romney hut one day. It must have been June the 6th, 44, D-Day. And I just had my dinner, getting me stuff back to the billet sort of thing. And bloke leapt out. He said, "They've invaded. They've invaded. We'll soon be home." Still see it now. But it wasn't to be there. So that was it. And then, of course, I got home to Lynham. They forgot to change all the French francs, didn't they? We had no money. I hadn't even got the price of a cup of tea. I think somebody took pity on us. So about 8 of us came back, if I remember rightly. And we got down to the railway station. Don't know which one it was now. Can't tell you. And I can't tell you which way we went, whether we came to Waterloo or whether we went to Euston or where. But I can remember pulling the trolley down the platform with all our kit on board. But we hadn't got the price of a cup of tea. No money, no nothing. So, I think it's good time for a sandwich, I think. And from Lynham, I went to, I'm not quite sure what station we went to, but I had to report to some place. It's a, can you excuse me a minute?
Just transferring.
Yeah. I had to report to a centre somewhere in London, somewhere in North London, I think it was. And I was booked in, and then I was, believe it or not, I was asked where I would like to be posted to. I thought, it's funny. So I said, Biggin Hill. There you know. Not too far from Catford. Oh no, we've got no vacancies at Biggin Hill. We've got Lord's Cricket Ground. Because that was a big depot there. More or less a transit depot. Vehicles used to come in from far and wide. And then we had a place for the chaps to sleep. And take the lorries out the next morning. I thought, well, that's good. I said, okay, I'll have that. That was the second time I'd been asked. But, and then I had to report to, where was it? And the Audley Room in Hamilton Terrace, St John's Wood, not too far from Lord's Cricket Ground. So I booked in, and then I had 4 months in London, and I lived at home. Traveled up to Charing Cross each day, got on the Underground, St John's Wood, walked down the road and into the depot. Facilities at the depot, just about basic, less than basic. You were working on maintenance on the vehicles, just keeping them going. If a lorry came in with a bit of trouble, so it was sorted out before he went. Before he went out the following morning. And it was bitterly cold, no overalls. I worked in my great coat. There was no hot water to wash your hands in at night, nothing at all. Toilet facilities just about nil. And of course, used to go through Charing Cross Station smelling the diesel oil. Grease all down the front of your great coat. As I say, no overalls, no nothing. Well, I got stuck by the SPs in Charing Cross Station one night when I was going home. And he says, improperly dressed. I said, I can't help it. I said, new facility. Told him where I was working. And I said, no facilities, no hot water, no nothing. Oh, look into that. Let me go. So I spent 4 months living at home, going up every morning, like I were being demobbed. The conditions at Lourdes was abysmal. No hot water or anything.
How did you find the country compared to that you'd left 2.5 years
ago? I couldn't see any difference, really. Still travel on the train all right. Don't think I had any trouble. Don't think it was any delays, like bombing or anything. Diversions. Used to get diversions sometimes from when I was working in 1940-41. We used to get diverted at Lewisham. But other than that, I think just about normal.
Did you have any experience of the V weapons?
V weapons?
The V.
Oh, V, rockets. I'm sorry. No, nothing at all. Doodle bugs, never seen one. I do remember when I was at this depot at Lourdes, we were always in trouble with London Transport. Because one of the tunnels was directly under the entrance to the Creekbound car park, that is. And we were damaging the tunnels with the heavy lorries. Yeah. And they had to put up with it, I'm afraid. There was no other way in. And there was one chap there. And he said... He came in one morning with his lorry. He's one of the staff of the, well, I say staff, one of the chaps who worked at Lourdes like I did. He came in one morning with his lorry. He said, I've got to go out somewhere this morning to deliver something. He said, I've left home. He said, we've got no coal, we've got no heating. He said, I'm going to have some of that coal. Pile of coal in the corner. He said, I'm not having my children cold. I don't know how much coal you shovel in the back of the vehicle. Well, we didn't even go out and delivered it. RVF coal, if you like. Nobody said anything. But that lasted 4 months. Yeah, it was quite good. A nice little cafe around the corner where I get a cup of tea. It was there that I really learnt to drive. Although I taught myself to drive in North Africa. And I drove vehicles in North Africa, but mainly I learnt to drive properly on, you know, British roads in 1944. And I passed my test all right. So, that was that. I was called to a breakdown one day, and we took the big, we were seeing the big Scammel recovery vehicles, and he took that out and put the tow bar on, one thing and the other, and a lady in one of the houses brought us out a cup of tea. Biscuits on a tray. Very nice, I thought that was. And then after 4 months, I had to say farewell to the folks again. I got posted out to Aden. And this was on the Medlock system, and we've heard of it. Where you go across the channel by boat to Dieppe, Then you get on the train, special troop train again, and travel right across France. It took, I'm not sure, 24, 48 hours to get up to Toulon, where we then met our boat. That was the Almanzora. Came out the scrapyard, or the breaker's yard. Well, it had been in a collision. The pointed end was stove in, pointing up like that it was. But they still used it. It had been a beautiful ship. You see that bar of the woodwork inside, the lovely staircases each side, but all the rest of the fittings had gone. And off we went, left Toulon, and I thought, well, being interested in steam engines and one thing and another, I'll make myself known, and went down the boiler room. Oh, Godfathers, what a crate. Some of the dials or instruments operated on a wall held together with string, where the things had to move to regulate things. Piece of string, I thought, brilliant. Anyway, we got to port side, right in the middle of a strike, and after port side, we went to where did I go from there? I went to a place called Kasfarit, another transit camp in Egypt. And we were taken from port side. I think we went by rail. Yes, we did. We went by rail. We stayed at Kasfarit, tented camp again, for several nights. And then we were then split into two lots. I can't remember how many airmen were on the camp. We were split into two lots. One for India, the other for Aden, or Mazira, Ireland. That was, I drew the short straw, Aden.
See, there was no element of choice in this post.
Oh no, nothing at all. I wanted to go to India, but I was in the wrong queue. But then again, Aden, you think to yourself, perhaps not too bad. But somebody said to me, you don't want to get to Mazira, Ireland. Do you know what went on there? There were two, I was told there were two Nissen huts and a mad doctor. And that was it. So, it's a tiny island off Arabia somewhere, not too far from Aden. So and we had to get on the train again, go back to port side. Then we got on the Highland Princess, a very nice ship, you know, cruise ship. And it was they got these brides on board. Well, I can't remember what they call them now. Well, at any rate, I was going to Aden. Went through the Suez Canal. Yeah, as we approached Steamer Point, I thought to myself, my God, What do I come to? Lasting mountains and rocks. Barren place. And of course, we got off at Steamer Point. Well, really, Aidan was a what was it? Sort of like a jumping off ground for India, staging point, staging post for India. Anyway, got off there, and we were taken then through Marla, a village called Marla. To Cormaxa, which was a proper camp. Proper built buildings, like two-tier flats. And very nice fans that got no air conditioning, of course. Fans that went round. And the billets held about 20, I suppose, 20 airmen. Nice and clean. Things, cupboards on the wall to put your stuff in. Being an NCO, I had room to myself and my own bearer, who fetched and carried. And we had the Dobie Waller, who collected the laundry. Absolute luxury. And he used to do the laundry, or several of them. I think there were one collected all the stuff, the dirty shirts and all that. I don't know where they washed the stuff, but anyway, didn't ask that. Anyway, it all used to come back neatly ironed and pressed and superb, luxury compared with the other places that I've lived in. And there was, I always remember, all our socks, every item of clothing, had a mark, identity mark. And my identity mark was an inverted V with a line each side. And invariably, there was a sock missing. You'd get your laundry back, you'd have the Dobie Waller back, you said, where's, I've only got one sock, where's the other sock? Oh, sorry, Saab. I must have lost it or something. I will go and have a look for you. Depart. Come back the following day. There's your sock. Oh, thank you very much. Next lot of washing goes in. Toby Waller bring back the washing. Bloke to further down the billet. He says, where's my sock gone? It was always a missing sock. And it was a proper built place. It was really nice. Tiled floors. Who had used it in the past? I imagine Aidan Police or something like that. Married quarters there. And, you know, everything. Well, compared to what I'd had, absolute luxury, except for the climate. It was hot. You can imagine, you work just a pair of shorts and probably sandals, something like that. Now, if I was out there with humidity about 98%, and I did that, you could watch the perspiration coming out in your arm. Literally. And I'm not exaggerating. Just doing that. Lift a cup of tea and beads of perspiration come out of it. So we had to take Mepocrine tablets for malaria, salt tablets every day, keep up your salt intake.